Hello, everyone. This is Jeff Sachs of Atid and Rebbe Shiva with another session in our study of Rabbi Soloveitchik's Halachic Man, dedicated in memory of Rabbi Ezra Labaton, Zichron Lebracha, by Michael and Tiffany Beda. My apologies, we are not meeting at our usual scheduled time. We're meeting on Monday night this week, as well as next week, which will be our final session before the break from Tisha B'Av until Rosh Chodesh Elul. So we have tonight and next Monday night, and then there'll be a short break. We'll pick up again probably at the beginning of September. A very difficult day here for the Jewish people. In Israel, in my hometown of Efrat, and for the Jewish people everywhere. So I just want to make mention of that. But it fits in quite appropriately with the topic that we've been studying. Rabbi Soloveitchik put forth a very difficult idea. It was so difficult that last week, towards the end of the class, I expressed my own inability to fully absorb it. The idea that the halakha regulates, just like the halakha regulates all experiences of our life, it also regulates the emotional realm. And the Rav told a very difficult story about his maternal grandfather, Rav Ilya Feinstein, and the death of Rav Ilya's daughter, and the emotional, almost stoicism, of the halachic man by processing everything through the prism of halacha. This is difficult on a number of grounds. It's difficult for us to understand. We who are not halachic men and women, the idea that the most intrusive feature of halacha, I mean, people might be willing to accept and understand and embrace the idea that halacha invades every nook and cranny of our lives, from the most intimate moments of a person's marital life to his bank account, etc., etc. But the idea that the halakha also is a template by which we can manage or navigate our inner emotional life is something that one can understand that it's something that those amongst us who are not fully halachic men might have difficulty understanding in the way represented in those stories. And it's precisely from this difficult point, and presumably Rabbi Soloveitchik was conscious of that, that he moves from that story at the end of chapter 12 into chapter 13. I would just mention that this was a theme that he touched upon in a number of other essays, and most particularly an essay published first in the 1970s called Catharsis. I just put up links now to the essay itself that you can download as a PDF, as well as to the link in the Web Yeshiva archives where I gave three or four talks on that essay maybe two or three summers ago, for people that are interested in more on this topic of the halakha and the inner realm of the emotions. Here, chapter 13. Obviously, all of these features contribute to the development of halachic man's individuality. Excuse me one second. Here we go. His character takes on its own particular hue. His autonomy asserts itself more and more, and his entire inner nature is determined by unique individual traits indicative of an ideal, noble personality. Rabbi Soloveitchik is conscious of a problem, because if the halakha really regulates every component of our lives, including our emotional life, where does that leave us as individuals? Does it turn us into little halachic robots? Does it turn us into little halachic Mr. Spocks, where the logic of the halakha controls everything? It superimposes itself on our halachic eyeglasses, and it kind of determines how we view the physical world around us. It determines and regulates our relationships with other people, with fellow men. It determines how we're meant to the kind of algorithm that we go through when confronted with difficult news, of how we're meant to think and feel and manage the flow and ebb of everyday life. So where is the room for autonomy? Where is the realm in which each person finds his own individuality, has room to carve things out on his own? The will of homo religiosus gradually wanes to nothingness, as opposed to halachic man. His selfhood, homo religiosus' selfhood, religious man's selfhood, is inexorably extinguished inasmuch as his desire to immerse himself in the totality of existence and to unite with infinity. Homo religiosus wanting to destroy, negate, wipe out, erase everything about him that is a function of his this-worldliness, it's all about an act of bitul. But halachic man, on the other hand, protects his own selfhood. He's always interested in preserving his uniqueness, his particularity, his soul's private domain. But where is that private domain of the ish halacha? It's all the halacha. He's like a walking Shulchan Aruch. He's like a walking Talmud. Where's the individuality? In general, wherever the moral law reigns supreme, the sense of individuality becomes deeper and stronger. We have already explained above that homo religiosus oscillates between two opposing poles, the nullification of existence on the one hand and a feeling of self-exaltation reaching transcendental levels on the other. In this world, there's bitul, there's negation. In his aspirations towards the higher realm, the supernal realm, homo religiosus feels exaltation. But it's all about the departure from here and the arrival there. However, even when he makes a supreme effort to scale the transcendental heights, the effort is not motivated by a desire to perfect his individuality. Homo religiosus is on the lookout for the escape capsule. The opposite is true. What homo religiosus wants is unio mystica, the mystical union with the divine, attachment to infinity, complete immersion and dissolution of the spiritual realm. In contrast to homo religiosus, halachic man forges for himself a concrete this-worldly personality. There's this reference to Kant, which I'll just skip momentarily. But if you go up to the top of page 79, the a priori law, the ideal set of the halakha, molds man's permanent character, imprints its stamp on his physiognomy. I presume that the Rebbe is speaking metaphorically here, but it sounds like he literally says the halachic man's personality, the impact of the halacha is literally written on his face, is literally etched into his appearance. The countenance of the rabbinic scholar testifies to a strength of mind and a spiritual stature that sheds its brilliant light near and far. His whole being is imbued with the dignity of uniqueness and individuality and displays a distinct streak of aristocracy. He is not a receptive type of homo religiosus who stands and waits for the revelation of the truth and inspiration of the Spirit. Skip ahead. Ish halacha approaches the world of halacha with his mind and intellect. Just as, and in this way, he's like cognitive man, approaches the natural realm. And since he relies upon his intellect, he places his trust in it and does not suppress any of his psychic faculties in order to merge into some supernal existence. In this way, halachic man is more like cognitive man. He's more like the scientist. The approach of homo religiosus, of the religious man to the world, is one of negation. He wants to remove himself from it. And that act of negation is, in fact, an act of erasing his individuality. Halachic man surges forward. Halachic man is like Adam II, the Kivshuha, to control the environment through making an understanding, a cognition of it. That act of trying to understand, that act of conquest through cognition, is the realm in which halachic man maintains his autonomy. Even though halacha attempts to regulate every sphere of our life, it leaves an arena, although to be clear, as he'll state momentarily, a very well-defined and bounded arena for individuality and creativity. And that arena of individuality and creativity is the intellectual realm. Now, of course, this opens a critique. The idea that the ideal of halachic man is an extremely intellectual elitism is a significant critique. The idea that the entire halachic universe is an intellectually elite is also something to which we have to turn our attention. But there is no doubt that the kind of stereotype of the Litvak, the Lithuanian Talmudic scholar, immersed four square in the four amot of halacha, of the Beit Midrash, the cold intellectual stereotype is not made up out of whole cloth. That the realm of creativity is the realm of cognitive study certainly opens up the ideal to some kind of mild critique. Halachic man is a spontaneous, creative type. Now here we're foreshadowing the theme. We have about another 15 pages left in this half of the essay. The essay is unevenly divided into part one, which is this long archetypical description of these three characters, of trying to understand halachic man by comparison to his two comrades, the cognitive man and the homo religiosus, the religious man. And then the second, much shorter part, which is a specific description of halachic man through his most distinct personality trait, his creative capacity. So this chapter serves as a kind of foreshadowing or opening up of the theme, which will be more fully developed later. But the idea that the one way that the halachic man maintains his uniqueness, his autonomy, is through the creativity. But here the creativity, not of he's not a painter, he's not a poet, he's intellectually creative. He is not particularly submissive and retiring. He is not meek when it is a matter of maintaining his own views. Those are characteristics of Omer Vidiosus. Neither modesty nor humility characterizes the image of halachic man. On the contrary, his most characteristic feature is strength of mind. He does battle for every jot and tittle of the halacha, not only motivated by a deep piety, but also by a passionate love of the truth. He recognizes no authority of the intellect, parentheses, obviously in accordance with the principles of tradition. He hates intellectual compromises or fence straddling, intellectual flabbiness, and any type of wavering in matters of law and judgment. Now, those parentheses are significant. The creativity of mind that he expresses is within a well-bounded tradition of an intellectual tradition, of an interpretive tradition. It's one thing to be creative, it's another thing to be wrong. The idea that anybody that knows a little bit of something can say something creative on any topic does not, in fact, make it true. Truth is still the yardstick by which we measure. And truth is and has to be factored or has to be understood within the parameters of the interpretive tradition. All of those books, all of what has been said by those that came before me, my ability to be mechadesh, one's intellectual ability to come up with innovative insight within the halachic realm, has to be, as the saying goes, the pygmy on the shoulder of giants. The pygmy standing on the shoulder of the giant can still see further than the giant himself, even though the giant measured against the pygmy is far greater. And points out, of course, that one can be a halachic man and a painter. That's certainly true. But that the creative act of painting, and my point was, the artistic creative realms of creativity are not what we're talking about here. This autonomy of the intellect at times reaches heights unimaginable in any other religion. The Talmud in Bava Metzia relates that there was a dispute between the Holy One, blessed between God Himself and the Heavenly Academy. There's two cases that he brings, both of them from the Gemara in Bava Metzia. I'll skip ahead to the more well-known one, which is, of course, the case of the Tanur Shel Achnai, which is in Bava Metzia, Daf Nun Tet, 59b. It's a well-known Gemara. It's almost such a well-known Gemara that I can probably just remind you of the highlights. There's a machloket in the Beit Midrash about a certain kind of oven, the Tanur Shel Achnai. Not important for our discussion what this specific kind of oven is, although it is, of course, important for the purposes of the Gemara, and it fits in very nicely with the issue at hand. But a certain kind of oven, whether or not it can or cannot be makabel tuma, whether it can or cannot, whether it is or is not ritually pure or impure. There's a debate between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. Rabbi Eliezer is machmir. He says the stove is tamei, it is impure. Rabbi Yehoshua believes it to be pure. Rabbi Eliezer calls on all types of divine proofs for why his opinion is correct, including ultimately a divine voice, including ultimately literally smashing down the walls of the Beit Midrash as proof of what he's doing. Rabbi Yehoshua rises to his feet and says, Lo bashamayim hi. It is not in heaven. The way we determine halakha is not with divine proofs. even if God himself were a member of this Bet Din, even if God himself were a member of this court, and he voted with Rabbi Eliezer, nevertheless, that would not determine the halachic opinion. The halachic opinion goes according to the majority vote. And Rabbi Yehoshua says, even God himself, who seems to be weighing in with his opinion on who's correct, by kind of sending forth all of these divine proofs in the aid of Rabbi Eliezer, or at the beckoning of Rabbi Eliezer, even God himself cannot outvote the majority. Because lo bashamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven. Once HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah to the Jewish people and authorized the Chachamim, the rabbis, to be the interpreters of the halakha, it follows a system. And the system is that the rabbis interpret the halakha and determine what it is. The Torah has already been given from Mount Sinai, and we pay no attention to heavenly voices. The Gemara then relates that after the halakha was determined to be in accordance with Rabbi Yehoshua's opinion, against presumably the opinion of God himself, HaKadosh Baruch Hu smiled at that hour and said, Nitzchuni banai, Nitzchuni banai. Let me just write it down here. You can see it at the top of the page. Nitzchuni banai. The literal interpretation is, my children have defeated me. My children have defeated me. In the halachic debate that we were having, in which God himself, through the person of Rabbi Eliezer, casts his vote, Nitzchuni banai, the majority of the Chachamim voted against me, and I, God, was defeated in the halachic debate. Rabbi Soloveitchik elsewhere, although interestingly not here, points out that the word Nitzchuni, like Nitzachon, which can mean to best someone, to defeat them in an argument or in a battle, is also from the Shoresh Netzach, eternal. That God is saying, my children have eternalized me. That God and his Torah are eternally relevant because we continue to debate it, we continue to determine it, we continue to paskin shilas and to make extrapolations and to keep it alive. And that's why God is smiling. More, if a prophet asserts with reference to any law, so that's what the Rav says. The Rav says this is a kind of, what did he say at the bottom of the previous page? A kind of autonomy which reaches heights unimaginable in any other religion. That the democratic, we don't often think of it this way. And as a matter of fact, the halakha has sadly often come under attack for being aristocratic. But in fact, it's really quite democratic. Doesn't mean that everybody gets a vote. But it's democratic in that sense that the people determine the halakha through the chachamim. And in other ways, even the simple people determine the halakha. And there are many examples of how that works, including the idea that the chachamim, there's a check on the power of the chachamim to institute decrees that a majority of the people would not be able to abide. Gzeira Shirov Hatzibur Einam Yechel Lamod Bo has no force. The prophet, the Navi, the transcendental man par excellence, has no right to encroach upon the domain of the sages, who decide the law on the basis of their intellect and knowledge. The Chachamim are not prophets. They're people like you and me, just a lot smarter. But they have no insight, no direct line, rather, I should say. They have no direct line to divine will other than the Torah that they have studied. And that is something, Torah Eina Yerusha, the Keter Torah or Munach Ba'omed Mukhan, anybody that wants can study. In that sense, it's democratic. The gates are open. It's true, of course, for many millennia. In reality, even if in principle the gates were open, in reality that was not the case. Certainly women were not involved and included. But all that has changed. So that the Navi has no more authority in determining the halakha than the Chachamim. As a matter of fact, the Rambam paskins that one of the 13 essential principles of faith is the uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu as a Navi. One of the Rambam's 13 principles of faith is belief in Nivu'ah, belief in prophecy. And then there's an additional principle of faith among the 13, that Moses' level or quality of prophecy was in a category unto itself. Nevertheless, we do not call him Moshe HaNavi, like we call Yeshayahu HaNavi, Yirmiyahu HaNavi, Eliyahu HaNavi. Most of the prophets in the Bible, their title is Navi. But even though Moshe was the greatest of all prophets, what is his title? Not Moshe HaNavi, but Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe, our rabbi, our teacher. Because as great a Navi as he was, and he was the greatest of all Navim, his more significant role was as the teacher par excellence. The first, the very first rabbi, the very first chacham, that's the title by which he is known. Because even the chacham even has more power than the Navi, because the Navi has no autonomy. The Navi, it's very interesting that the Rav does not make this point, because these are things that he does mention elsewhere, and it you would naturally think it fits in with this theme here in this chapter, but he doesn't introduce it here. The Navi has no autonomy. The Navi has no more autonomy than a radio. You open the radio, you tune it to a station, and the radio transmits the sound waves that are being broadcast from somewhere else. He's a conduit, a messenger. Of course, the Navi has his own charisma. He has a role as a kind of leader. There are other things that he does have where he can exhibit certain types of autonomy. But qua the Nevuah itself, the prophecy itself, not only has he no autonomy, he has no right to suppress the message that he has. That's part of the message of Yonah. Yonah thinks he can run away from his role. He has no more control over his message as prophet than the radio or the television have over the content that I might tune the device to. But the chacham, the rabbi, the sage, has the autonomy. And the autonomy is in that creative intellectual realm. Halachic man is a mighty ruler in the kingdom of the spirit and intellect. Nothing can lead him astray. Everything is subject to him. This is further reference to the example of the calendar, the degree to which the Chachamim have autonomy even to determine the date. The way that the Jewish calendar works, certainly in the times of the Kiddush Al Pi Re'iyah, when the witnesses would come and the Chachamim would sanctify the new moon. And then there's this quote here from Shmot Rabbah from the Midrash. To what may this matter be compared? To a king who had treasure houses filled with gold, silver, and other precious stones, and had only one son. As long as his son was still a minor, his father would watch over everything. When the son grew up and came of age, his father said to him, as long as you were a minor, I would watch over everything. Now that you've come of age, I'm turning over everything to you. Thus, God would watch over everything. When Israel came of age, he handed over everything to them. That the giving of the Torah and the setting up of the halachic system of the Torah Shebaal Peh was a kind of mark of coming of age of the Jewish people, of the Bnei Yisrael. It's that trust that you have, that sense that you're ready to give the keys over to your child who has matured. I have a son who's coming up on getting his driver's license, my eldest son. It's quite petrifying, the thought that your kid is going to start to drive. There's so much to worry about as a parent. But you know, they have to leave the nest. Right? When your kid is very small, when the baby bird is very small, the mother sits on top of it and doesn't let it out of the nest because it'll fall right out of the tree. At a certain point, the mother bird literally kicks the bird out of the nest so it'll learn to fly. That is Matan Torah. That is the giving of the Torah, not just the Shnei Luchot Avot, the two tablets of the law, not just the written Torah, but the oral law and the authority to interpret it in that creative realm. That is the mark of becoming mature. Halachic man, I'm skipping down to the bottom of page 81. Halachic man received the Torah from Sinai not as a simple recipient, but as a creator of worlds, as a partner with the Almighty in the act of creation. The power of creative interpretation, chidush, into the realm of intellectual creativity, is the very foundation of the received tradition. This is a longer topic, which is merely telegraphed here, but something that we've spoken about so many times in the past, I don't feel the need to go into it. But of course, the idea that the written Torah, the Torah Shebichtav, was given part and parcel with an oral tradition, an interpretive tradition, the Torah Shebaal Peh, because on its own it's not understandable, and that the Chachamim, the sages, the rabbis of old, not rabbis today, had an authority to do the type of interpretive, midrashic work of determining the halakha through the Torah Shebichtav based upon certain interpretive rules in order to figure out the Torah Shebaal Peh. That's the power of creative interpretation, and it's the foundation of what was given at Har Sinai. When Moshe ascended on high, he found the Holy One, blessed be He, sitting there tying crowns to the letters in order that future generations should, by virtue of the powers of creative interpretation, discover heaps upon heaps of laws contained in every tittle, in every jot and tittle. That's a midrash, appears in the Gemara Menachot, about Rabbi Akiva, fairly well known. If it's not, so then I suggest you look it up, but I'm going to skip it now. And then there's this lovely quote from Chaim Volozhiner. Chaim Volozhiner, the founder of the yeshiva, the great student of the Vilna Gaon, has a commentary on Pirkei Avot, and this is the commentary on Pirkei Avot is called the Ruach HaChayim. This is a quote from that source, where he says that only man, and again, of course, pardon the gendered language, only humanity is capable of creative interpretation, of chidush, something which is beyond the power of angels. For since the Holy One, blessed be He, created them in a state of perfection, they need not and therefore cannot develop in progress. It's a beautiful idea. What makes us unique is our imperfection. Angels who are perfect have no imperfection. Angels who have no yetzer hara, who have no evil inclination, have no need to improve themselves. And our intellectual quest as a species has to do with that need to improve ourselves in the realm of Torah, but in the realm of everything. This comment here would apply equally to cognitive man, who looks out at the movement of the stars. Remember those beautiful passages from earlier in the work. Looks out at those, the movement of the stars, and wonders about his place in the universe, and wonders about the mechanics of how the planets move around, and wonders about physics and astronomy and biology, and questions the mechanics of life and the mechanics of science, and is awed by creation. But part of the awe leads to not the impulse of homo religiosus, a desire to leave this world and find that which is transcendental, but instead a desire to understand how it all works. In that way, again, halakhic man is more like cognitive man, but that desire to perfect himself through cognition for halakhic man is focused on the halakha. But again, remember the halakha, not only questions of if I forget Yalav Yavo on Rosh Chodesh at night, what do I do? That's a halakha question for sure. But halakha in that sense of the blueprint of the world. That's the area of creative space, or one of the areas of creative space. So unlike the angels, who have no need for intellectual curiosity because they're perfect, we are imperfect and we want to improve ourselves. And that expresses itself in the moral realm, and it expresses itself in the intellectual realm. And it's a sign or a mark of the degree to which intellectual pursuits are bound up together with the moral realm. Thus, the sages have added fences and guards around the law which would not be possible had the Torah been given to the angels. For in that case, it would remain forever unchanged without addition or diminution. But we who are imperfect, we need guardrails. The essence of the Torah is intellectual creativity. The gist of his world perspective, of halakhic man's world perspective, to which he gives expression in his explanation, or the gist of the world perspective of Reb Chaim Volozhiner, and Reb Chaim Volozhiner certainly is a halakhic man, the gist of his world perspective to which he gives expression is, in his explanation, is that it is man who gives life to and constructs the worlds that are above him. The whole of transcendental existence is subjugated to him and under his sway, which is the mirror image of homo religiosus. Homo religiosus feels oppressed by this world and tries to escape it, tries to transcend it. Halakhic man doesn't need to transcend the world to get above. He transcends what's above and brings it down here to the realm of that kind of cognitive creativity, the realm of chidush, in which we understand the world by understanding the halakha, by being partners in the creation of halakha, which is, after all, the prism through which we view this world. And that's the area that he maintains his autonomy. That's the area that he remains unique. Even though halakha does stretch out and try to regulate every corner of his life, it's at the heart of the halakha. The halakha, of course, is a learning system. It's a system of thought. It's a system of intellect that superimposes itself on life, on daily ritual, on human behavior, on human interaction, on civil law, on ritual law, on sexual law, on our appetites and our desires, and yes, even our emotions, as evidenced at the end of the previous chapter. But it's precisely in that realm of determining the halakha that we can maintain each and every halakhic man can maintain his uniqueness through that act of interpretation of that realm. That is the autonomous realm of the halachic man, and he really starts bringing it all back together as he's wrapping up this section or moving towards concluding the section. You see all the themes that had been playing out earlier coming together and being fed back in the comparison, this kind of act of comparing halachic man to homologiosis, halachic man to cognitive man and homologiosis together, how it comes back in, and then bringing it all back together to understand the uniqueness of halachic man. We will next Monday, for the final session before we go off on a little break, we'll continue with chapter 14. And I hope that by then we will have good news for those of us here in Eretz Yisrael and for the Jewish people the world over.